An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Life After God podcast. My name is Ryan Bell. So glad you're with us today. I have a really exciting interview to bring you today with Professor Philip Kitcher from Columbia University. He is the author of the new book, Life After Faith, The Case for Secular Humanism. He, for years, has been a mathematician, a scientist, and a philosopher and an historian of science. And with this book, he really brings his focus to the question of secular humanism and some of the big challenges that secular humanism often faces from religious communities and religious philosophers. So I was excited to read it. I think he handles in this book so deftly questions around ethics and how we ground ethics in a post-theistic world. A lot of times the criticism that we get from Christians is that without a transcendent, without a God, there's no basis for making judgments about right and wrong. And he really handles that question carefully and with great deference to the challenges of religious believers. He takes their arguments extremely seriously and grants them a legitimacy, and then addresses them from his philosophical viewpoint. So he does that extremely well. He also addresses issues of finitude and mortality and how life can have meaning and value if it's not connected to something transcendent or the immortal life promised by a lot of religious belief systems, including Christianity and Islam. So how can a life be meaningful if it's temporal and temporary? So he delves into that as well. He talks more specifically toward the end of the book about how we can embody secular values in our society, what that would really look like, what that would require. And he's very honest about the setbacks and limitations of secular humanism at the present moment, realizing that it's, as Bart and I were saying last week, fairly new. New kid on the block in terms of moral communities that are articulating values into the public space, but nevertheless really important to continue that process of growth and dialogue. As always, in the show notes and on the Life After God website, I'll include links to Philip's book and some other interesting information about his work and his previous work. And so I hope you'll check that out. And if you enjoy a foray into philosophy, I think you'll really, really appreciate his book. So before we jump into the interview, and I am sort of sick casting here from the Life After God studios today, I did not want to miss this opportunity to interview Philip Kitcher. So I'm doing so with a stuffy head. So I don't want to drag this on too long and subject you to my weird voice. But before we get into the interview, just a couple quick shout outs. Thank you so much to all of you who have been supporters on Patreon and the additional supporters we've had over the last few weeks. Thank you so much for joining us in that. I've also added a new staff person to our Life After God team, Brian Peck, who's our new director of social media and marketing. He's been creating memes on the Facebook page for Life After God for quite some time now, very under the radar and just as a wonderful volunteer. And he's still a volunteer, but I've invited him to officially join the team. And he's just such a great addition, helping us get the word out about Life After God and the work that we're doing. And to that end, we, in the last few days, have begun to use a new hashtag, which we want to invite you to also use. It's hashtag I want believers to know. And then a short statement of what you would like believers to know about your non-belief or your deconversion or your new place in the world, whatever, however you want to describe that. Sometimes, minority groups, including atheists and skeptics, feel misunderstood by the world that is different than them. And so we just wanted to invite people to write, heartfelt or even maybe funny, statements of what they would like believers to know. And it's already going quite nicely. If you go to Twitter and search the hashtag, I want believers to know, you can go back through the ones that have been posted so far. You can go to Facebook and do the same thing. Search that hashtag or go to our Life After God Facebook page at facebook.com/ourlifeaftergod. And you can see the memes that Brian is creating there with some of the quotes that people have submitted. So go there and see what's up and add your own. Go to Twitter and Facebook on your own newsfeed or send us a statement and Brian can make a meme from it if you like and hashtag it. I want believers to know and keep the momentum going on that. It's a wonderful way to build bridges and communicate across what sometimes are very contentious differences, and I really appreciate Brian's creativity in thinking of and innovating ways to help get our message out to a wider audience of people. Also, a quick little milestone that we've passed. We've been going about 5 months now, and according to the Spreaker website, we have a little over 50,000 plays so far, which comes out to about 10,000 plays a month. And I just really am grateful to each and every one of you who listen faithfully to the show and have invited a friend to check it out, have posted a link to the show on your social media accounts, and just helped us get the message out about this new podcast. You know, 5 months isn't very long. This is only episode 21 so far, so we have a long ways to go. But I'm just so grateful for this really energetic and positive start to what I hope will continue to be a vibrant service to people who are in the throes of doubt and disbelief and questions. And so thank you for being our early adopters and our champions out there in the social media world and with your friends and family. If you have any thoughts about the show or just want to write in, you can write to me at ryan@lifeaftergod.org. Links to all of our social media are on the website, at lifeaftergod.org. And you can, of course, support the show financially, which is really important to us, at our Patreon page, patreon.com/lifeaftergod. And as we raise a little bit more money, we are planning to expand and do some new things with the podcast, including starting a second podcast with my friend Laurent Schultz, and also doing a special series, a thematic series, that I'm calling the Secular Virtues Project, here within the framework of Life After God itself, and doing more themed shows with lots of different voices chiming in on various themes around secular virtues. So lots to look forward to, and appreciate your support, and look forward to hearing from you. Now, without any more delay, here is my conversation with Professor Philip Kitcher. Professor Kitcher, what a pleasure to have you on the Life After God podcast this afternoon.
Well, I'm very glad to be able to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been fun to read your recent book, Life After Faith. And ever since I started into it, even before that, actually, I thought I would love to have a chat with you on the podcast because it's a thoughtful and penetrating book. And we'll get into some of the questions I have, or just the thoughts about it, in just a moment. But it's definitely a challenging book, compared to the size. You know, sometimes when I pick up a small book, I expect, I'll get through this quite quickly. And that was not the case with your book. And I really appreciated that.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I hope it wasn't too much of a heavy going slog for you.
No, not at all. No, I actually appreciate that, and I think there are a variety of needs out there in the readership, and there's a lot of good humanistic material. But sometimes what I miss the most is a deeper philosophical dive, because people are, as you indicate in the book, you know, people are asking some really important questions from the other side of the argument that deserve to be taken seriously. And sometimes I think humanists and atheists have a tendency to wave their hands at some pretty important questions that I appreciate you taking really seriously. And I hope we'll get into some of those in just a second. But before I do, I would love from, I mean, you know, just to say, I've actually never spoken to you before. So this is my first time chatting with you, and certainly probably for most of my listeners, the first time hearing from you personally. So I wondered if you would give us just a little bit of background on your sort of philosophical and religious background and journey. A lot of what we do on this show is to talk with people that are sort of in between belief and unbelief and navigating that space that can be so challenging at times. A lot of people who are in the process of deconversion, as we sometimes say. And so I always like to find out from my guests, like, what their process has been. Maybe, you know, maybe you've never been religious, or maybe you had a deconversion experience of your own. What was your experience like?
Well, I am on the other side of deconversion. I've been relatively clear on these topics, I would say, for 40-odd years. Mm. I am not as young as you are. I was brought up in a liberal version of Christianity. I was brought up within the Church of England at a time when the Church of England was moving very much in the direction of emphasizing the social benefits of religion, the importance of personal relationships. I was an adolescent at the time when the then Bush Bishop of Woolwich, John Robinson, wrote a book called Honest to God.
Ah, yes.
In which he said, the time has come to get beyond the idea of a man with a long white beard somewhere up in the sky. And his version of extremely liberal Episcopalian Christianity really emphasized the personal and the social dimensions of religion. Now, I had begun, as I say in the book, by singing in the church choir, which I started to do at the age of 5. And music throughout my life has meant a great deal to me. And so I attended services regularly. I went to a religiously founded boarding school, of which we had a church service every day and 2 on Sundays. So I have logged a lot of time in the pew. And I've heard a lot of sermons, listened to a lot of readings from the New Testament and the Old Testament. And I sometimes surprise my philosophical colleagues because, you know, when they're searching for a passage in the scriptures, I can sometimes complete it for them. And that's because I've heard these words so often and they've sort of sunk into me at a very impressionable age. But when I was about 14, I started to get the first sort of stirrings of skepticism about the whole enterprise. And that continued going backwards and forwards sporadically, really throughout my teens. I continued to sing in choirs. I continued to sing religious music. Even when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, I was a member of the Christ College Chapel Choir, and I went to services. When I was a graduate student at Princeton, I continued to sing. I was a soloist for the Princeton Chapel Choir. I've sung a lot of great music in the Princeton University Chapel, but really from the time I was about 20 on, which is, I hate to say it, nearly 50 years ago now, I have not been a believer.
That's fascinating. I mean, for a lot of my listeners, it's fairly recent, but I do have the pleasure of talking to a number of people who have been, you know, half of a lifetime or more on the other side of belief, and that's certainly where you're at. Was it, raised in a liberal tradition like the Anglican Church, I suppose it wasn't as bad as for some others that were raised fundamentalist, but were there family and social challenges that you faced in your letting go of religion and faith?
It was a terrible shock to my mother that I'd lost my faith. She found that very, very hard. For her, religion was deep and central to her life. She was a woman who did not have a very easy life, and my parents were not at all well off. They were, in fact, quite poor. And I grew up in a community of people for whom the church was very much a center and a place of consolation and social support and of mutual aid. And the sorts of things that Robinson was talking about when he advocated a social and personal turn in theology were vividly present to me in the religious community that I knew as a child, as an adolescent, and as a young adult. So it was very hard for my mother. She thought I had lost something extremely precious and extremely important. And I very much sympathized with her feelings of grief, really.
And, sure.
And I tried to console her and reassure her that even though I had left the church and lost my belief, I could still understand what was so important in it for her. I think we reached before her quite early death. My mother actually had diabetes. Was diagnosed with diabetes before insulin was available. So
oh, wow.
She had extremely tough life. I think, you know, by the time of her early death, we had understood one another on this.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think that's so important for a lot of people, because I think, and you address in the book, one of the major topics is the issue of immortality or lack of immortality, our finitude, and the fear that accompanies that realization. And I know for my believing family, probably one of, and they've expressed to me in some sense, the biggest concerns or the thing that weighs on their minds the most is the sense that I would spend eternity lost or separated from them. And was that a concern that your mom had as well?
I'm not sure that she would have put it that way. I'm not sure she was so literal about the idea of a permanent afterlife.
Right.
No, she just thought that a relationship with God was important throughout this life, as well as in whatever happened afterwards.
Right, right. And do you think that your religious upbringing and your inquisitiveness about theology as, at an early age led you to study philosophy? In other words, was this sort of for you like a natural extension of when theology fails, you keep doing philosophy kind of thing?
No, actually not at all.
Interesting.
I drifted into philosophy. I mean, I grew up in the British system where you had to specialize quite early. I mean, I had to choice at the age of 15. I had to choose between doing literature and foreign languages, which was one combination of subjects that appealed to me, or mathematics and physics. And I chose to do mathematics and physics. I went to university to do mathematics and physics. I spent my first 2 years at Cambridge doing mathematics. Really, it's really mathematics and with a bit of mathematical physics thrown in. And then I realized that I wasn't going to do anything creative in mathematics. And my tutor at Christ College, Cambridge, suggested to me that I talk to a historian of science friend of his. And that's what got me interested in doing history of science, and that led me to philosophy of science, and that led me more generally to philosophy.
Wow, that's fascinating. I mean,
it's an indirect route, and it really doesn't have anything to do with religion. But I must say that throughout my intellectual career, as a philosopher of science, the issue of religion has always been very important to me. It's always been something on which I wanted to write, and I wanted to think through the issues. And this little book, Life After Faith, is really my attempt to do that. I've made some previous forays into this territory, but I never felt satisfied with what I'd written. And now at last, I feel I've said what I want to say.
Oh, that's lovely. I was just going to ask you where this book specifically came from, and that's really on point. I think it came at a good time for me. I don't know how much you know about my story, but I was a pastor in a rather fundamentalist denomination for nearly 20 years, and then spent the year 2014 exploring the limits of theism, and I had been asked to resign from my denomination because of my support for LGBT individuals in our church. We were still trying to sort out whether LGBT people were actually, you know, worthy of God's love and redemption. And I had far too much of that, and I had started to just express myself and was asked to leave. And when I was asked to leave, it really sent me into an exploration of all of these questions. So I'm a relatively new deconvert, about 2 years or a little less even. And the challenges that I receive mostly from people online who interact in my blog and so forth, are, you know, Christians that are pressing the questions, the very questions that you address in the book. And, I notice also something that I don't see very often, among atheist authors, and I don't mean to peg you in some sort of, abstract category there, but I noticed that you take a great effort, you go to great lengths to not create a straw man of Christianity. You go to great lengths to almost make the Christian arguments for them, to say, well, you know, my hypothetical, you know, interlocutor would perhaps say this, and the more, and you call them refined believers, you know, would move on to say thus and such, and kind of equivocate here and there. And you try, it seems to me, in a very, very slim volume, give a lot of room for this refined theology. Are you in regular contact with these refined believers? Is that kind of what motivated you into that? Or are you just really wanting to, like, create a thorough exploration?
I have to say, some of the religious people I know are, I think, completely different from the way in which religious people are portrayed in the books of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, even my good friend Dan Dennett, whom I think of as the best of the so-called new atheists.
Yes.
It seems to me that there are particular people I think of. One of them is actually the godmother of my younger son, who is a deeply religious person. She is indeed associated with the Episcopal Church. She plays a role in the Episcopal Church in one of the states. I'm not going to say any more than that because it doesn't seem right to give details. But she is an extraordinary person, and her way of believing is anything but naive or literalistic.
Right.
And I know sufficiently many people like that. Some of the best people I know. Hmm. And I will not caricature them. I believe very honestly that religion comes in a large number of forms. There are people for whom the literal word of everything in what they take to be the scriptures matters a great deal. There are other people who think about their scriptural texts in terms of moral messages and who think really quite minimally about Christian doctrine. For them, the importance is perhaps the fact of the death of Jesus and the great sacrifice that Jesus made and the symbolic weight and significance of that. There are others who have a somewhat larger theology, who want to make certain kinds of historical claims about the life of Jesus, or about the messages that were given to the prophet, or about the covenant between God and Abraham. I mean, this comes in various religions, or even outside the three Abrahamic religions, the three monotheisms. There are Hindus with a relatively minimal theology who I think are very much on parallel lines to certain Christians and Jews and Muslims that I know. For me, it's very, very important to realize that many religious people are inclined to say something like this: I'm not really entirely sure what the words of my preferred sacred text mean. They are very important. They seem to me to point in the direction of a part of reality that atheists just dismiss completely. These people would go on to say that they view other religious traditions as also trying to find access to this part of reality through metaphors and images and so forth. I have considerable respect for that attitude.
Well, it seems like a universal human attitude, doesn't it? Like, some people are trying to answer the questions of life's purpose and meaning and significance. People try to answer those questions in various ways. You know, some people will write a novel and others will write poetry, and some turn to religion and others turn to, you know, analytical philosophy and mathematics. And there, it's again, it reminds me of this sort of proverb of the blind men trying to describe an elephant, you know, and they're all describing a little bit of it. And I don't mean that to say that appeals to sort of invisible intentional agents is necessarily like an intellectually responsible way to go about that. But the impulse behind it seems to be this universal impulse to understand the world, at least the best of those practitioners.
Yeah. So I'll be very clear about this. I don't think that there is this transcendent part of reality. I think that... if you like, the material, physical, organic, human world is what there is, and there's nothing beyond that.
Right.
But I can understand that for some people, they feel that there's something beyond. Many of those people are very confident about how to describe it. They say what's beyond is the Christian deity and all you other guys are wrong.
Right.
That seems to me a completely unwarranted attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody should suppose that the doctrines of any one religion are privileged. So I think the appropriate attitude is to say, well, there is something beyond, and we are all in our different ways trying to describe it, and it's literally unfathomable, but it can be expressed in other ways, in poetical ways, in imagistic ways, in allegorical ways, and it can inspire our behavior towards one another and the ways in which we live socially with other human beings. And I think that religious attitude, although I disagree with it, is worthy of great respect. And that's the sort of thing that was exemplified in the friend about whom I spoke a few moments ago, the godmother of my younger son.
Right, and I know many of those people as well, and I have deep respect for them. And in fact, I'm related to many of those people, and
right.
They're in my own household. So I definitely understand that. That impulse to seek something outside of the natural order. I did it. I mean, one of the main reasons that I can empathize and understand is that I did that. When atheists will sometimes say, well, you know, religious believers are just naive and stupid. I'll say, well, you know, for 30 plus years, I was a believer and I don't think I was naive and stupid. There were doors I hadn't yet opened in my intellectual and emotional life. But that doesn't mean I was stupid or maybe naive in some sense, but not in that pejorative sense that people...
Not at all. I mean, let's just think about the Christian tradition. Anyone who can think that Augustine was a stupid man hasn't read Augustine. I mean, he is the guy who conceived of the genre of autobiography and memoir. I always tell my students that if Augustine were living in the 21st century, he would probably be winning a Nobel Prize in something or another, and a big one. I mean, this is a man of colossal intellect, and the tradition continues. I mean, if you look at people, some of whom I refer to in the book, like William James,
and right.
Martin Buber, and Paul Tillich, these are all extraordinary intellects. They are not naive, and they are not to be dismissed with cheap jibes about the flying spaghetti monster either.
Well, and their intellectual lives were always unfolding, weren't they? And one of my favorite sort of, you know, mental games that I like to engage in once in a while is to think, you know, I was just at a conference actually at SBL, Society for, it was the American Academy of Religion, where they were doing some Tillich papers. And And I was sat there the whole time thinking that they were describing a Tillich from the 50s and 60s. Or I think that's right. I think I'm getting the time frame right. If he were, you know, so I was sitting there doing this little mental game, like, well, if Tillich had lived the last 60 years, where would his philosophical and ideological loyalties lie? He may have evolved into a post-theist. It seemed that he was on that trajectory anyway. And it just seems so typical of ideologically based communities to put a stake in the ground where their favorite person passed away and say, okay, this is where, you know, the evolution of our, you know, mental framework stops, you know, and we have to build a house here where we all can live, you know. And I, to me, it just seems that all of these, William James, as you mentioned, and Tillich and others were always evolving and growing, which to me is the impulse that we should all embrace, not what they thought, but the way that they thought.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with what you've just said. On the other hand, I do think that beyond even the most refined religion is a kind of secular humanism that says, no, there isn't really any transcendent aspect of reality, but we can learn from and absorb some of the things that the great religions have done in terms of their fostering of human relationships and their fostering of society. I think it's always important to remember not just the dark side of religious belief, often exemplified in religious strife. That's something that Hitchens points to in his book, God is Not Great, but also the extremely positive aspects of religious life. I mean, we've just celebrated Martin Luther King Day.
Well, that's in my notes as well. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Luther King is such an important figure and a man who did great good and advanced the cause of social justice in this country and indeed more broadly in the world. And I think when one looks at people like that, one can see how religious movements have been places at which moral advance and progressive social change can happen. And that's something which, from which I think secular humanists can learn in their own efforts at building community and fostering human relations.
It seems to me, and I, you know, in my personal experience, one of the reasons I resonated with your book so much is that there's a general sense of humility about this sort of secular humanism that you write about, and the sense that to learn to be grateful for. Well, first of all, to learn to accept that we are finite and that reality is, our perception of reality is limited and that we don't live forever and we can't have all the answers all the time. And just to accept that and yet to press on in our understanding and our learning has been for me a kind of exercise in humility. And I think also recognizing the humanity in others as they try to learn and grow in the same way has been a similar, I guess, for me, exercise in humility, and I really pick that up strongly in your writing.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that came across. I think there is much that we don't know, and perhaps there is much that we will never know.
One of the things I wanted to touch on, I think one of the, you know, it's fun to read books as they get towards the end, things start to become from many writers more concrete, and in the second to last chapter on morality and meaning, you start to talk in more slightly more specific ways about how secular humanism might take shape in our society to sort of build on the learning and the growth that we've had as a society, both from religious leaders like Martin Luther King as well as other secular leaders. And you talk about secular, you say on page 117, secular society might respond to the problems of economic and social justice, honoring the egalitarian ideal of the provision for all of the preconditions for a meaningful life. You go on a little bit later to say, beyond declaring abstract rights, we should demand that the world's resources be shared so as to allow all people, or more exactly, to all people except those whose biological limitations cannot be overcome, the opportunity for a meaningful life. I mean, that's in this current political climate, and though you come from Great Britain, you've been living in the United States for quite some time, I'm sure you're quite dialed into the political realities that we're facing. This is quite you say it in such beautiful prose that it could slip by people, but that's sort of like Bernie Sanders talk a little bit right there. Like, how do you feel this vision gels?
I'm probably to the left of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
No, it seems to me that one of the great messages of the world's great religions, or at least parts of the world's great religions, is this extreme egalitarian message that we're all important and that we all deserve a chance. And we all deserve a real chance. We come into the world amazingly dependent on other people and on other structures within our societies. And if we're to live lives that at the end we can endorse and say, yes, I'd be prepared to do that again if I had the opportunity. If that's to happen, we need an immense amount of help from our surrounding society. We can't just be cut adrift and told to get on with it and make our own way and do our own thing. Resources really do have to be put into the sorts of things economists call public goods. Resources really do have to be shared so that all children have the chance, really, to find themselves, to find their own direction, to find what matters to them. And so when I think about the problems of mortality and meaning, as I do in chapter 4, I think of them in two ways. There's a theoretical problem. How do we make sense of a meaningful human life knowing that it's going to end?
Right.
Perhaps, if people are fortunate, after 80 relatively vigorous years, perhaps earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make sense of that? That's the intellectual problem, and I think that problem can be solved, and I think that secular humanist intellectuals can respond to the idea that even though our lives are finite, they have a larger sense through our connections with others. But there's a much harder problem, and that is the problem of building a world in which a lot of people, all people, well, except people whose, you know, birth gives them a biology that makes certain kinds of things absolutely beyond their grasp, all people, other than those, can have the opportunity for this kind of meaningful existence. How do we do that? And it's right here that I go back to the kinds of things that I think the churches and the synagogues and the mosques and the temples do at their very best, creating community, creating support, creating structures. And I think that we have an ethical obligation to do that, that the primary ethical obligation is really to respond to one another and respond to all. And in this, I'm at one, actually, with William James.
Mm.
He comes at this from a very, very different direction. He sees us all as having a claim on one another. And that seems to me important and fundamental and correct. I think I'm very glad that Bernie Sanders is saying the things that he is saying. My wife, if she were here, would say, well, they're not original with him.
Of course.
And nor are they. But it is very good for our political discourse that he is injecting this message into the conversation, I think.
And that it's getting as much traction. I mean, every time I get a little discouraged by how much traction someone like Donald Trump is getting, I try to remind myself that there's a corresponding traction that Bernie Sanders is getting from his base.
I'm heartened by this, and I'm very heartened that he is appealing especially to younger people, and that is a very good sign. It means, I hope, that these kinds of messages won't be going away, that they won't just be a passing bit of the political scene. We are also living in a country in which many Christian denominations seem to have forgotten the message of the Sermon on the Mount. They seem very, very much concerned with resisting policies and measures that distribute wealth more evenly, that give people opportunities and so forth. And that has always, since since I became aware of this sort of, I have to call it Christian movement, because that's the way the people within it would call it, even though it seems to be to be missing one of the most central and essential features of Christianity, namely Jesus's command to go out and give. And it puzzles me that people can be so absolutely sure of themselves as Christians and not feel the power of that particular message.
Well, when I was a clergy person, I was doing a lot of community organizing around social and economic injustice and trying to elevate the voices of those that were experiencing that injustice and their demand for equality and equal opportunity, as you say. Like, I think sometimes people get hung up, just briefly to point this out, people sometimes get hung up on equality as if the goal is that by some political process, we will enforce equality across the board. And to be clear, what I hear you saying is that the goal is to create an equal opportunity. The essential building blocks of a good life should be available to everyone, whether they utilize those in a good way. I mean, obviously people will fail at their efforts to live a good life, but society should give them a fair start and a fair shake along the way.
And possibly a second start if they need one.
Or multiple starts. That's right. Because the fate of all of us is different. And you, I love how beautifully you also point out that how glib the secular humanist vision of a good life can sound to someone who perhaps lives in sub-Saharan Africa in extreme poverty and is inclined to say, well, that's really nice for you, that you get three square meals a day and can, you know, revel in the wonders of taste buds and good wine and, you know, good friendships and leisure time spent discussing, you know, lofty ideas. But, you know, people are dying every minute in my neighborhood, you know, and for them, you know, that's to me where the rub is. I mean, where the vision or the ideal of humanism doesn't meet with the lived reality of two-thirds or more of our world's population.
Well, you began by asking me to be autobiographical, and when I reflect on my life, I feel that I have been extraordinarily lucky. If you grew up in the class that I grew up in Britain, you'd probably be a lot better off than those people in sub-Saharan Africa, but you wouldn't have the opportunities normally that I've had. I got very lucky in that I went to an absolutely superb school that enabled me to develop intellectually, to find my own way. And I've been very, very fortunate to be able to have a wonderful career teaching at various American universities and to wind up at one of the really great universities of the world, at Columbia University, teaching extraordinary students. And I have to say, I just feel extremely fortunate. Now, not everybody would want the precise kind of life that I've had. I know that. But it seems to me that I wish we could live in a world in which all people had the opportunity early in their development to be well educated, to have their health taken care of, to be cared for by people who love them, to have opportunities for participating in a nurturing society, to choose their own career paths, to find out where their talents lie, and to go forward on that basis. Now, to do that, we need far, far more, I think, than even the most liberal governments in the world today provide by way of public services.
It seems like the trick is to convince those that have those resources in their possession to believe that it's their shared responsibility to accomplish this vision that you have.
It's also important to say, as the Pope very eloquently has in his recent encyclical, that the kinds of toys that the very rich so often buy are not the building blocks of a wonderful life. The kinds of things that matter most to people are having a project, a purpose, a task that they take on and they regard as important and they see as contributing to something larger than themselves. And beyond that, the relationships that they forge, the community in which they live. Those are the important things, the things that make you feel happy and satisfied with your life. And that has nothing really to do with having a huge yacht or exercising massive amounts of political influence through your campaign contributions, anything like that.
Right.
It's available. It's available on lots of different scales. And it seems to me that one of the things that the churches at their best have done, and I very much admire the way the Pope has again and again sounded this theme, is to wean us away from a kind of vulgar, unsatisfying, competitive materialism and to steer us in a different kind of direction.
Yeah, really, I love that idea that it's unsatisfying. And my first introduction to that was from an environmentalist, a famous environmentalist whose name is escaping me at the moment. He's a contemporary. It may come to me. He wrote a book about what it's going to take to sort of preserve the environment. And he talked a lot about greed and consumption. Mm-hmm. And he cited some studies that showed that at a certain level, the peace of mind or quality of life begins to diminish with increased wealth. And they were able to point to, you know, an inflation adjusted, sort of economically adjusted number, which I think at the time in America, maybe 10 years ago, was something like around $150,000 a year. That beyond that, you start becoming less happy with your income. With more money, you become less happy at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's pretty good evidence that if you take people who are making $75,000 a year or more in contemporary American dollars, the distribution of people who are satisfied with their lives and feel that they're living well as opposed to people who are not is pretty much the same at
right.
all levels beyond that.
Yeah.
So it's as though it doesn't really make a difference if you have more. Now, there is a point, as you've said, at which you know, material goods bring their own sort of forms of worrying, their own pathologies. But, you know, John Stuart Mill said this wonderfully in his own Principles of Political Economy, which he wrote, you know, now nearly two centuries ago, over 150 years ago. He says, "I'm not charmed by the vision of life in which it's a perpetual struggle to get on and in which we stumble and stamp on one another all the time."
Right.
I'm not charmed by that vision either.
Yeah. Poverty is not something to aspire to.
Poverty is not something to aspire to. But neither is this is the rat race into which at the moment so many, perhaps all, young Americans are born.
I'm getting we're getting towards the end of the time that we set out for this, but there's a couple things I want to try to squeeze in here before we go. And there's a couple different directions I could go, and I'm wrestling here. I think I want to follow up on something we were talking about before, which is the role that religious communities play in advancing a humanist agenda in the world. In other words, I would have said, perhaps not in these words back then, but when I was a pastor, I would have, in the words I have available to me now, I might have thought of myself as a Christian humanist. But now I wonder, like, how viable is a notion of Christian humanism in as much as Christianity has within it almost like a suicide pill or a way of mitigating against the very achievements that they're fighting for? I mean, depending on how seriously and literally you take the texts, of course, but you say at one point that secular humanism is really the only legitimate. No, I don't, you didn't say legitimate, but let me see if I can find the actual quote. You said humanism can only be secular. So I wonder if we've been quite generous to Christianity and religion so far. I wonder if you would offer a critique of religion as it relates to humanism.
Okay, well, I'll be happy to do that. But let me say first of all that I think that the kinds of community efforts that I've seen, and it sounds as though you've participated in within Christianity, and there are similar things in the other major world religions as well, are just terribly important. I think one really important thing for atheists to understand is that for many people who lose their faith, they lose their community too. They have no other place to go where serious issues can be discussed freely and openly, where projects of importance can be formed in which they can participate along with other people, where systems of mutual support and consolation can be available to them.
So yeah, absolutely.
I think is a really important thing, and it's going to take... It will probably take a long time to build similarly successful structures within a completely secular framework.
I agree. We were just talking with Bart Campolo about that.
I don't think that the fully secular world is going to be built overnight. I mean, that's taken Christianity a couple of thousand years of experiments, and I think they've got some things down pretty well.
Yes, indeed.
But now it seems to me that the real problem here is that it's not just that we've got no evidence for a transcendent aspect to reality, but the idea of a transcendent is a distraction. It invites us to think of our horizontal relations to one another as if they were somehow sanctioned or rendered important by our vertical common relation to some transcendent. We are all children of God, for example. And that just seems to me an unnecessary and often a problematic detour. The importance, and now I'm going to go back again to John Robinson's message in Honest to God. The important thing is our relations with other human beings.
That's right.
Those shouldn't be filtered through the fact that we are all servants or children or worshippers of God. It should just simply be there, freestanding and independent and at the center and focus of all of our lives and all of our concerns. And so I think in the end, humanism can make use of all sorts of good things that come out of the major religions, but in the end, it has to cut free.
And that filter that you describe, like filtering our loyalty to one another as humans through a sense of the transcendent or a sense of us being children of a divine father figure or something, often, and you point this out in the book as well, contains elements that are sort of diametrically opposed to the agenda of humanism, the place of women and sexual minorities and so forth.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting that you described your own journey in terms of your concerns for LGBT people in your community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one place in which historically, of course, Christianity and Islam and even Judaism have founded in their humanistic commitments. And even to this day, we still see that many, many, many religious denominations, I praised the Pope a while back, but on these issues, he has not been good.
Right. That's right. So it's a mixed... And I think you do a nice job in the book of just letting that be a mixed bag without having to sort of say, and therefore it's all bad or therefore it's all good. Just say it's a mixed bag. And it seems to me what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that for your part and in using your influence, you would encourage people to let go of that sense of the transcendent to avoid that mixed bag. But nevertheless, the mix is there and that some religious communities are contributing positively to some things.
Yeah, they are, and they're providing, I mean, they're often providing the community structures that are truly important.
That's right.
For people's lives.
Yeah.
Until secular humanists can do as well, there's going to be an important aspect of religion which is generally lost by those who go through what you've called deconversion.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I just wanted to ask you sort of a quick fire question. I know as a thinker, as an intellectual, you're probably always toying with new thoughts. What's occupying your mind these days? And I guess another way of saying that is, you know, what are you reading and writing now? What's on your mind?
I'll tell you, because this morning I was writing a chapter for what I hope will be a book on how to respond to climate change.
Oh, beautiful.
And it's very much in the spirit of some of the things that we've been talking about. And it sees the Pope's encyclical Laudato Si as a kind of a particular religious version of a common core of argument that can be articulated in thoroughly secular terms. And I guess what I want to see is a kind of general movement that cuts across people, secular and religious, cuts across all religions, and that understands the importance at this particular juncture of our acting together in a concerted and generous and egalitarian way to do what we can to save the only planet we have.
That's right. Well, that's such a timely comment, too, because my last interview, my last episode, was with a philosopher, a friend of mine from Norway named Laurent Schultz, and he had written a paper on called How to Survive the Anthropocene, and suggesting that an adaptive atheism is a, you know, an important aspect of moving forward in this dialogue about climate change. And so I'm really excited to see what you're writing next, and see how it sort of fits into this bigger dialogue, because I do think that of all the big issues we have to face as a human society that transcends national boundaries and so forth, you know, it is this issue of the survival of the biosphere.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think this issue is entangled with two others, both of which we've touched on. One is the issue of human inequality. And those people you talked about in sub-Saharan Africa who are yearning for development. And the other is the issue of those religions that are not prepared to say, well, there are these other traditions and they're gesturing at a transcendent aspect of reality and they're seeing it in their own terms. I mean, the religions that say things like, I'm right, all the rest of you are wrong, and because my God wants it this way, I feel that I must do everything I can to bring you into line, even if it means doing conventionally immoral things to you.
That's right.
Like torturing you.
Right.
Or killing you. Or enslaving you. Or raping you.
Yeah, it's unthinkable.
I'm afraid that that these three issues, global inequality, intolerant religion, and the movements that it's currently inspiring, and climate change, are all interrelated. And a solution to the climate change problem has to come to terms with the other two facets of this.
Well said.
So very difficult.
Yeah, beautifully said. And thank you. You know, I don't want to take too much of your time today, but I really appreciate you carving out a space for us to chat and share your thoughts with my listeners. And I hope they will appreciate your book as much as I have.
Well, I've enjoyed very much talking to you. Thank you very much for the conversation and giving me the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
Well, we'll do it again, I hope. Well, there's Philip Kitcher, professor of philosophy at Columbia University. What a gentleman and a scholar. I felt like I could have continued that conversation for hours, as with many of my guests. But I sense something deep in him that I resonate with, that I'm sure that given the opportunity, we could have a wonderful evening with a glass of scotch and a lot of rich conversation. So I can only dream that that might happen someday. But what a privilege to chat with him for a minute here on the podcast. And I hope that you appreciated that. As I indicated toward the end of the interview, we could have gone in so many different directions with the conversation and the little time that we had left. But you know, these conversations kind of have a life of their own, and I'm trying to respond to what he's saying and sort of build on that and move through some things. And honestly, he touched on a number of things that I was hoping that we would get to. So I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope that you'll go out and check out his book, Life After Faith, The Case for Secular Humanism. It's by Yale University Press, and it's only 150-some-odd pages long, but it's quite a dense read. I don't mean a boring read. It's just very philosophically argued, and if that's not your usual territory, I would encourage you to take this one up as a challenge, because he's saying a number of really important things in this book that I think would give you a real sense of grounding if you're a person who's new to post-theism, if you've relatively recently grown out of your faith. I think that this book would give you some solid ground in sort of articulating your new worldview to people who may not share it. And if you're a Christian and sort of in that liberal progressive side of Christianity in particular, I think you will find his generosity to communities of faith very winsome and with a lot to work with there. And I, you know, we only touched on just the slightest bit of what he writes about in the book. And I wanted to ask him a bit more about grounding values, how we ground ethics outside of an appeal to the transcendent. And I unfortunately, we didn't get to get into that issue, but this book has been one of the most helpful in answering the questions in my own mind and those posed by others about that issue. And I thought I would just read a quote for you, which I find particularly insightful and beautiful, from the very end of chapter 2 called Values Vindicated. This is page 59 of his book, Life After Faith. He says, "My version of secularism places humanity at the center of value. It does not need a detour through some dim and remote transcendent. Nor does it see vivid vindication of human worth in supposing, whether literally or metaphorically, that we are children or servants of God. My naturalism conceives us as both creators and loci of value. Our work of creation prompted by the exigencies of human predicament. Out of that work, carried forward in the ethical project, has come nothing less than a transformation of human existence, through the forging of connections among people and through the expansion of the possibilities of human lives. As we reflect on that transformation, we may regret some, even many, of the details, but we can only affirm and celebrate the project itself, constitutive as it is of those we have become. That, I suggest, is dignity of values enough." And that's how he closes out chapter 2. Really, you know, beautifully written and tightly argued, beautiful prose if you enjoy that sort of thing. And so check it out and see what you think. Let me know what you think of the interview. Write to me at ryan@lifeaftergod.org. Visit our website and sign up for our newsletter at lifeaftergod.org, and you can stay in touch with all the things that we're working on. We're working on some new expansions and developments within Life After God, just a baby organization, and so we're still laying down some of the groundwork and building up some of the framework. So bear with us as we do that, and join us and share your thoughts and ideals with us as we do that work. I'm gonna wrap this up a little quickly here today, because I'm, as I said before, sick casting here from my dining room in Pasadena, trying to fight off the remaining effects of this cold, as you can tell. So I don't want to subject you to my nasally voice any longer, but I do appreciate you tuning in. As always, share this with your friends. I think this, again, is an episode that would be so valuable to share with people on all different sides of the question of secularism and faith that would inspire rich conversation. I think you could play this and then have a long conversation with a good friend about what it means to embody humanistic values, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a secular atheist, whatever you are. There's a lot here to talk about. So do that, share it around. And if you like this podcast, if you've appreciated the work that we're doing here, I would really appreciate your financial support that helps keep this program growing and developing. And you can do that at patreon.com/lifeaftergod. I really do appreciate everyone's generous support up until now, and look forward to many new things. For now, that's it for me. I'm Ryan Bell, and this has been Life After God.